Perfect.
Okay.
And the quote of the day today is "Time, the devourer of all things, Ovid." I don't really like that one.
Sounds cool, though.
Publius Ovidius Naso, known in English as Ovid, was a Roman poet.
Shout out to Publius.
That's funny. He was a poet during Augustus Caesar's reign, who was the first Roman emperor. So saying time is the devourer of all things at the start of the Roman Empire is kind of chat, because you saw it coming.
Yeah, he knew.
The artist, Devin.
You could just kind of say that whenever, though. I feel like anytime you say it, it'll be applicable.
True, but it's especially prescient as you're founding Rome. You're like, I think time's going to devour us. And I was like, stop it. We're all happy still.
It's like a Debbie Downer over here. Publius Downer.
Yeah. We're rambling, Devin. How are you? I pulled up the last time you came on this program. Do you know when it was? Because I do.
I'm going to guess 2021.
Wow, you're on the money, and it's exactly 3 years ago this week, episode 195.
Really?
Oh, you came on and we all talked about Stranger Things coming to Dead by Daylight and Steve's every 4 year NHL game purchase theory and the recently released Bombing, which Steve and I had been playing. And then we talked about Runt, which we hadn't played because we're not nerds, but we did, of course, support. And that said, Devin, when are you doing another non-video game? You've been meddling in this video realm for a while.
Another non-video game?
Yes, back to a TTRPG or make a board game or something.
Well, I mean, I did do a video essay recently in the last like week, so I guess you
that
could
counts.
Say a few days ago, basically.
Excellent.
I bounce around, you know.
It's a mixed medium artist.
Exactly.
I feel like your expertise, would you say, is level design?
Yeah, that's what I build myself as.
But what would you say your expertise is if you were talking, you know, to like me and God?
Oh, God. I would first apologize to God, and then I would say, I don't know that I feel like I would say anything. Like, okay. I'm kind of just a generalist. I do a bit of everything, but I don't know if that's a good, interesting way to phrase it. Level design is fine.
Okay. I do have some actual questions rather than just, you know, spitballing with someone we haven't talked to in a while. Sorry about that. I feel bad because you're, I should mention to the viewers, this is the CanadianGameDevs.com podcast, episode 20241, FT, Devin Wiersma, level designer / apologist to God, designer of Bombing 1 and 2, and most recently, Centauri Dark.
My sci-fi roguelike arena shooter. Kind of bullet helly vibe, very anime-esque. It was my first time
out now on Steam and Itch.io.
Yeah, first time making something that was like very action-oriented. I don't normally do that, hence me making a bunch of games where you make a bunch of weird art. So it was interesting.
Buy it now.
I want to get some interview juices flowing. What's the most interesting thing you'd say you did in a game lately?
Nothing.
Excellent. You can leave it there. That's the state of it for me too, buddy.
I mean, I don't know, like that I've... That I've like put into a game or that I've seen in a game?
Yeah, either or.
Mm.
Usually can't talk about the first until someone else plays it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been playing a lot of Dragon's Dogma 2 lately. Ever since that game came out, I've been insanely Dragon's Dogma pilled. It's the first game I've played in a long time. But that game does, it does a lot of like interesting stuff that I can't say because of spoilers, unfortunately.
Right.
But there's totally some mechanics in that. And anybody who played the first game is probably kind of privy to stuff that happens in the second game. But it pulls a lot of things out that not everybody sees coming, and I don't know, it's just generally been surprisingly pleasant. As someone who has a hard time playing games nowadays and having fun with them, like, it's surprising to me that I've played 200 hours and I'm still having fun.
So the interesting thing from Dragon's Dogma 2 to explain would spoil the narrative, which makes me think it's in some way like mechanically, narratively enmeshed, and that's really interesting to me because I've been struggling a lot lately with video games, kind of feeling like oil and water a bit, where there's the 45-minute cutscene and then you resume operating the device and then you put the controller down for the 30-minute cutscene. And I'm searching and I'm desperately reaching and grasping for anything that like puts the gameplay and story together. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, like, I won't say that Dragon's Dogma 2 story is like good. I think there's a lot of ways where it totally flubs what it's trying to do, but it definitely has like, it's not afraid to like do kind of crazy stuff, which I think is where it sort of comes in interesting. I totally know what you mean too, where like the oil and water thing of sometimes you're just sort of playing games and like they're all feeling sort of the same. I think the thing, I don't even know if I maybe mentioned it last time I was here, maybe, but I think the turnaround point for me was playing Nier Automata, where playing that game, there's so many things it does weird and like funky that as you're sort of playing it, you go, oh, video games can like kind of be cool. Like they don't have to all be the same and like not interesting or fun or like afraid to take risks. They can kind of do crazy stuff. I think that was a turning point for me with that sort of thing where I was like, oh yeah, games are all right sometimes.
That's so interesting because you're talking about like the structure of the game narratively and how it incorporates the mechanics. And this is kind of related to an interview I was watching with Quentin Tarantino where he was talking about an interviewer asked him like, oh, why do you make movies non-linearly? And he said,
if I had written Pulp Fiction as a novel and I was on your show, you would never even remotely bring up the structure.
Flashbacks or whatever it was.
You would never bring it up. All right. Because it's like a novel can do that no problem. Novelists have always had just a complete freedom to pretty much tell their story any way they saw fit, all right? And that's kind of what I'm, you know, that's kind of what I'm trying to do.
Whenever something is different, it gets interrogated for its differentness and not like explored for what it is trying to do. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that kind of feels like what you're talking about.
Yeah, totally. And like that, my thing as someone who consumes media, and I think I realized this a long time ago, was whenever I start to see the pattern of something, and like once I can sort of predict where it's going or what it's doing, I lose all interest entirely because I'm like, okay, I've seen this, like I know this pattern, and my brain shuts off. Not that's necessarily a good thing, but like that's just how I consume stuff. And so yeah, like it's kind of like the whole monomyth structure where it's like, oh, the hero's journey, you know, you start from you go through that same repetitive loop, and like now when you watch like, I don't know, movies and stuff, you see that same structure over and over. So whenever you get like some kind of piece of media that is obviously trying to do something that's vastly different than that, it just automatically stands out by virtue of not doing the exact same thing or like doing enough to kind of keep you guessing and keep you on your toes, which is always refreshing. It's a nice little hit of mystery and variety, which is pretty cool.
Yes, but we do not like to invest in mystery and variety. We like to invest in sure things.
Yeah, exactly.
with numbers at the end of them.
Yeah, 100%.
Speaking of investing in developing things, what the hell is Bean's team doing, Devin?
Nothing right now. They've
interesting.
Have a studio called Beans.
Yeah, this one.
In Toronto.
Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're working with Devolver Digital on...
probably a game, maybe.
Yeah, well, we're working on something.
I don't know.
And we'll announce it, we might show
probably
it.
Probably never.
Yeah,
never.
They've gone under. Yeah, I got laid off from them earlier last year.
Man.
The publisher cut funding and, you know, revenue streams no longer were there, so got laid off and
joins the Reaper walking into each door meme of Game Studios.
yeah, basically. Okay. We were kind of earlier on in the whole layoff thing too. It's a shame because now everybody's getting laid. Now it's the cool thing to do, but we did it early on. Come on, guys.
It is. PC Gamer put out that graphic of all the layoffs by weeks since January, and it just kept going up.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about it this morning, too, and I'm like, man, I'd rather, like, a lot of these studios they're making games that I never was going to play anyways, but, like, I'd rather everybody be employed and making games I'm never going to play than everybody suddenly getting unemployed and having to survive. It's depressing.
That's a rock and a hard place, though, because as I'm getting insanely more cynical about games, like the choice between like, hey, keep coming in and working on this thing that you don't really think needs to exist or struggle to pay rent. I'm like, well, you're like asking me to like lose a hand or an arm. And I'm like, I guess I'll lose a hand, but I'd rather do something else.
Oh yeah. No. Well, it's definitely like lesser of two evils kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's not the ideal for most people, but I mean, it's bread on the table, which is better than no bread, I guess.
It's more than bread for you though, right? Cause you do games when you don't have to pay rent with the, money you get from it, right? Like you chose to work on games in your spare time as well, and I wanted to pull that up because on your site you say it's, quote, the difference between making games for work and for play. So I was wondering, does that mean like for you the process is more playful when it's not getting paid to be done, or is it the difference between making a game that like someone's trying to ship as a product and for play as like you want someone to play this and experience this a certain way?
So the background on it is, I totally was making games. I've been making my own and publishing my own like solo developed independent stuff for the past 5 years. I think I started technically in 2019, so it's probably been about 5 years now. And I've been averaging like a game a year or something. And it originally came about mostly because I was making games in like a studio context in like a putting bread on the table kind of way. And I was miserable about it because I had no sort of creative choices that I could make
we can name them, Devin. We can name them. you were making Ubisoft games.
Oh yeah, well there's that. But it's also like I wouldn't even just blame that necessarily. Like it's just the whole kind of industry structure. Like, you know, you're making a game for a mass market audience and you're making it underneath, you know, people who have different directorial ideals than you. Like it's kind of just generally, you know, that's how it operates. And that was kind of grinding me down, and I started like, because you know initially I had made games myself before joining studios, and I found like once I started getting back into that and making my own stuff, I was like, oh, I can just like make the things that I want to do. Like I can make the interesting creative decisions. Like they might not necessarily be good or mass market appealing creative decisions, but they're ones that I get to make and ones that kind of like I can chase the dragon that I'm forming in my head, as opposed to trying to like build to somebody else's dragon that they've built in their head. So that's kind of where it all started. And then, yeah, I think I sort of just found like a sense of liberation through that, where I can kind of create my own art in my own way on my own time. And even though it was still stuff that I was doing for work, it didn't matter so much because it was art that I really enjoyed creating. And at the end of the day, like if you're enjoying the process, the art doesn't matter because the process is what's keeping you interested and having fun. So yeah, it was very liberating in that sense. I could just kind of chase my own processes and do my own thing and not have to worry about like being a middleman or appealing to anybody except for what I think myself and other people might want to play, you know?
Yeah, I get that. And it's sort of like probably an experience that's sort of true all throughout history of people's specialized skill sets, like game development. Like if you were really good at painting the letters on storefronts in the 1910s or whatever, and you just did that all day and you got paid to do that, but then you got home, you're like, oh man, I want to paint like a meadow or something that like I'm interested in.
Yeah, totally.
I feel like that's sort of universal human experience as a artist.
And I think like
forced to pay rent through art.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I think I was reading, I didn't know anything about Andy Warhol. For some reason, I go on like Wikipedia spiral sometimes.
Same.
Where I'm like, I don't know anything about this, so I'll spend an hour reading about this.
Yes.
But I think that was also like his thing, where he started doing like illustrations for like shoes or something, and that's how he developed his style. And then outside of that was just kind of, you know, started adopting what he was learning from all of his like graphic shoe illustrations and turn them into like pop art. It's like, yeah, it's kind of just, if you're someone who likes creating, it's hard not to just always be creating even, and like kind of turning that into creation on your own terms. Totally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think a writer we've done artist and now game developer, a writer I really like who did that was John Swartzwelder, who has the most single writer credits Simpsons episode of anyone in the world. But he got his start doing advertising copy in Chicago for like, you know, just brands like for toothpaste and travel companies and stuff. And then from there, he got onto Simpsons, and you would think that's like the height of your career or whatever. But he really just did that until he said it stopped being fun. And then he published like 25 small, like 200 page paperback novels about a time traveling detective. And he's described that as his like most fulfilling and like his genuinely like most interesting work. Cause it's like you're describing, he's entirely in charge of it. It's what he wants. His publisher kind of, you know, he's John Swartzwelder. He does what he wants. And at that point in your career, he's just like building to that mode of creativity where you're like, this is what I want to do because this is what I want to exist.
Mm-hmm. And like, that's a great place to be in. And obviously there's like a pretty healthy degree of privilege that comes along with that sort of thing.
Yes.
Like you've reached the point where like, that's just a thing you can kind of do. And like, I think sometimes also I also have a healthy degree of privilege where like my life situation is stable enough just like financially, and I have a partner who helps financially support me, so it's definitely not like I am just really good at this and I deserve to do it. It's like I'm very lucky that I can do this, because especially like the transition from doing this while like making my own games while I'm, you know, putting bread on the table through full-time game development for a few years, and then transitioning to now you don't have a job and you're doing this, like that was that was and is still a really weird thing for me. Part-time I do like contract work at York University teaching as a course director for one of their programs, so I'm still like, you know, working in some capacity, just less so. But
yeah,
it was really weird going from doing this for fun, and then I don't have a job, and this is the only way that I'm currently making money. Like it definitely changed my mindset going between those two, because now it's like, oh, this is my job now. Like, this is no longer for fun. These have to sell. And that was very strange.
So then that obviously changes this process of, yeah, as you say, work or games for play into more of a games for paying rent. And so does that change? Obviously, that would, I guess, change the kind of games you're making, because now is the primary goal for them to make money on Steam?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of was that way, and then it's kind of like shifted back and forth, like depending on the week. You know, depending on how you're feeling, we're like, man, I don't know, money's starting to get tight again. Do I have to? I've got really bad anxiety about like financials and stuff, so it definitely gets like that, where it's like, oh, I had a bunch of bills this month. Like, do I have to double down on promoting everything? Do I have to change like the direction of what I'm doing? Previously, a lot of the games that I've made are like, just in, like we were talking about, just informed by like what I think would be cool or the kind of games that I would want to play. But there is a degree of now, like when I find myself in between projects, it's like, okay, I have to like make very smart and conscious decisions about like how saturated the market is, what kind of stuff people probably want to play, what people expect me to make that my existing fans would want to see, and also the kind of stuff that I would have fun building. Centauri Dark was interesting because I think it's probably my first game where I was like, I want to make something that a more general audience would be interested in playing. And I think honestly, it did burn me out a lot trying to build to those kind of specifications versus just building something. Like Bombing is a lot more of a game that's kind of from my heart. I have a lot more fun and what's the word? I guess more, not like interest, but I have more, there's a greater variety of things that I haven't explored with Bombing that I think are fun to kind of play with. So switching to Centauri Dark, where it's like, okay, I'm kind of consciously making something that I think would have a more broad appeal, is kind of like hard and remain to be kind of hard. But I pulled through and I did it, and there's, you know, going to be content updates and stuff that I'm going to continue to push out and whatnot. So, but yeah, it was an interesting shift.
Bombing as well was something, wait, you can cut this if you want, but you have firsthand experience with public art on the street, right? So that's something that you have a specialized skill in another area that you wanted to merge with this one in an interesting way, versus the specialized skill of working at a company that knows how to position a product and then applying that to an indie game is probably just a much less interesting process. And as you were saying before, it didn't really matter if the end result was good or not, as long as that process was enjoyable. And so it sounds like the process for Centauri Dark was less enjoyable as a result.
Yeah, and it's definitely the thing where like you got to make sure the end result is good. Like with Bombing, when honestly, the first Bombing especially kind of like caught me by surprise how interested people were in it. And that's definitely part of what inspired me to keep working towards like Bombing 2, because people play the first one and turned out to really enjoy it, and then people enjoyed the second one as well. So shifting to IPs to something that I think needed to sell, and like also I didn't have money, and like there's a lot of different components to that just adds a lot of pressure to the pressure cooker that certainly changed the way that I view development in a way. And I think because of that burnout, I'm taking like just a little bit of a break. So it's been like 2 months since Centauri Dark came out, month and a half or so. I've casually gone back to some prototypes and stuff that I think would make for fun future games, but I'm totally like tempering it. Previously, when I would go shift between projects, I would be shipping one project and then also be prototyping another project as I'm shipping the other one, kind of as a way.
Classic.
Yeah. Kind of as a way for myself to mitigate burnout. Yeah, they do that at studios all the time, but like now it's me. But it kind of served as a similar thing where, you know, the one is getting shipped and like that's a certainly different part of the process than, you know, prototyping stuff, which is a lot more adventurous and playful. So it kind of helped me sort of split, you know, having to do the hard work and having to do the like fun work. But now I'm like, I'm not making games for like a couple months and see how I feel, just to, you know, recuperate from the accumulated burnout.
Devin, we have not recorded a podcast in a month or so, so we fully support taking creative breaks from the thing you really do.
No, totally.
I wanted to get back to the surprised interest in bombing one, because that for me, I was super interested in it because at that point in my life, I was thinking about games in terms of their verbs and realizing every game's verb was kill or shoot. and the market seems to want more of those. But bombing was a game where you sprayed and looked and stood back. And so that was really interesting. And I think that's speaking to what we were talking about earlier in terms of like the structure of the thing itself, just by being different makes it interesting and makes people and draws people to it, like Nier Automata, where it's like, whoa, this isn't a straightforward roll credits and big explosion at the end thing. How do you think we make more bombings? Because obviously it's not enough to pay everyone's rent, but those are the games that I think are exploring different verbs and making games more interesting overall.
Yeah, I want to plug Natalie Lawhead.
That sounds familiar. I think I've seen that on Twitter.
Doing some interesting work in like interactive media stuff, and she has a lot of interesting insights on this sort of topic, where a lot of the interesting stuff comes from the more indie developers who don't have the same constraints as the market. Like they're generally doing the same thing I'm doing, where it's like just trying to build stuff that they think is interesting or build stuff that has a sort of playfulness or spontaneity to it. And I think the reason that a lot of the I say bigger indies, but I mean smaller indies, like the very tiny indie people are doing that, because I think that's kind of what the market is in a weird way almost forcing them to do to some extent. Where like Centauri Dark was interesting because it's sort of built as a Steam game, you know, a game that would appeal, I think, to users on Steam because it's very shooty and actiony and graphically cool. But I think
it looks good on the new releases tab.
Yeah, exactly. Like
all those look really good as GIFs and stuff.
Yeah, but like a lot of games on Steam are like that. So it's in that saturated market of everybody is making like a roguelike shooter, you know, action oriented sort of thing. So in a way that because it has so much of that market saturation and competition next to it, it's harder for it to stand out because every indie is building that because that's typically what we perceive as selling to some extent. And yeah, the stuff like bombing, I think, is just more interesting because people see that and they go, hey, it's not like every other thing that we've seen. And it kind of stands out by virtue of that alone. And I think the way to, I guess it's hard to speak to like how to get more of those kind of things outside of people sort of realizing that they don't need to. Well, you know, this is where it always goes back. And I know you're very familiar with this, where it's like, you know, investing in the things that actually make money means that the things that actually make money are the most boring things out on the market. And the things that don't make money so much are the things that are interesting because they're kind of doing it not out of making money, but out of just making something that's kind of weird and fun.
Yeah, the indies are doing R&D for the studios, or the giant AAAs that are then just picking the research and developed system or mechanic that does well enough on Steam to chart, and then they put that into their next thing.
Yeah, to some extent, exactly. Like there's a degree of, I think, just indies have the freedom to be experimental because a lot of the time they're doing this as like a side thing or as a way to just experiment with the medium of making games on the whole. Like the students that I teach, you have to go to great lengths to encourage students to be that experimental and to really kind of branch out from the comfort zone of everything that you're familiar with. But once they do it, you're like, oh, if this was on the market, like, people would eat this up because it's already so much weirder than like half of the games that you see out there. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like an interesting and fine balance to find. I don't know. I guess the challenge is with the way the industry is now, finding ways to support those people who are doing stuff that is very experimental and very weird and very like groundbreaking in terms of verbs and in terms of, you know, all that stuff that actually makes them interesting, and finding ways to support those. And I guess like, for people listening, the best way that you can do that is if you have an indie that whose stuff that you like or that you think is weird or experimental or you want to see more of, even if it's not perfect, you can like buy their game, leave them a review, like leave some kind words, tell your friends, like that sort of stuff.
Yes.
I think from like just in terms of grassroots, like helping build support for them is like invaluable. Like the biggest changes that I've had so far, like the best support that I've ever received is all the people who just play my games and like leave a review and go, yeah, it was pretty fun. Like it doesn't even need to be an amazing review. Just like, hey, I played this for like a half hour and got a big kick out of it. Maybe you should play it too. Cause that's the stuff that people react to.
It lets you see the ripples of your work. And it's the same thing. Like it's only happened a couple of times where we've been at like EGLX or something. And a guy comes up and you're like, can you game devs? I'm like, whoa, someone outside my living room's heard of this. This is crazy.
Yeah, exactly. And like, even in market terms, it's helpful. Like on Steam looks at reviews and stuff too. And like once there's enough reviews for something, it'll just start to promote it more. So you'll boost the dev's emotions by helping them feel way better. And also actually boost the game by potentially getting in more people's faces. And because I think too, there's a lot of the time we'll complain about stuff in the industry, but we won't actually do that much to try to, I guess, push to change it. Like we'll go, ah, dang it, why do they keep making Ubisoft games? And then everybody goes out and buys and plays all the Ubisoft games. And it's like, well,
yes,
the best way is to buy and play all the little games that you maybe don't ordinarily go to. And
I'll say from the media side, everyone's talking about Ubisoft games. Like they found out that one person writing the new samurai game wrote a gay Japanese samurai book. And that was like the whole talking about games for 2 weeks. That's all just air, you know, that's nothing. You should talk about all these cool games coming out with different verbs on Steam. And I wanted to get back to, I think it reminded me, you were like, how do we make people think about games this way? I was thinking for existing game developers, I read an interview with Shigeru Miyamoto in The New Yorker where he was talking about the next generation of Nintendo designers and what he's looking for. And he says the one thing that he doesn't want anyone to say is that they're a gamer and they love games. Because he's like, I already have 25,000. He says what he's looking for is photographers and painters and filmographers. Why did I lose the word for director? But, you know, he's looking for people with, or he mentions pottery, I think, or something. He's just looking for people with different creative perspectives they can bring to the team that is already the best at the world at making video games. Because that's the only way you'll get new and interesting video games is by adding new perspectives. And so I think in the same way your game resonated with a bunch of people bombing because you took your perspective of doing street art into a game because that was something you knew how to do literally with your hands. Both make a game and do street art. All of these people coming to Nintendo making these weird new innovative things that are what they call, you know, the next gen, like Splatoon and NES Remix and ARMS and these games that are actually not all third-person action RPGs like Sony games. You know what I mean?
Totally.
It's because they're adding those perspectives and selecting for people who do something other than play games.
One of my old professors from college, Cindy Paremba, I remember she was like, the two people who make some of the strongest game designers are the people who have played a ton of games and know absolutely everything about them, which I wouldn't, I guess, even classify as being a gamer. Like, I feel like gamers play games but don't really think about them in any meaningful context. That's just kind of, you know, do it for fun. But, like, the people who play games and, like, really dig into them and, you know, are very analytical about all of it. Or the people who don't play any games at all because they have the freshest perspective. They don't know the existing limitations and the existing things that are already being done in the game space. So they just kind of do their own thing and think of it with more freedom. So I think that's kind of also like an interesting angle to it too, where some of the neat game stuff that you see is like not necessarily people who are heavy gamers and game developers doing things. It's people who are like, I don't know, 3D artists who are like, I just want to make a game and see what happens, or people who are kind of games adjacent trying to get into the space and seeing what they can do with the tools and the software that's there.
Yeah, MIDI keyboard shit posters who are a fan of certain web comics from the early 2000s suddenly bring a fresh perspective to game development.
Exactly, stuff like that.
Yeah. Oh, man. No, it's beautiful. I think everyone should go birding. I think if you spend 5 minutes every morning stepping outside and trying to find a bird to look at, your games will get better.
Is there a birding game?
Oh, there's gotta be. Oh, there was Toem, that Swedish black and white one, I think. That was like a bird photography game. One of the launch Playdate games was a birding game. I remember you used the crank as like the adjust the focus of the camera.
Ooh. Yeah,
What was that one called?
That's good.
But yeah, no, that's those, and those games were interesting because the verbs were bird. I've never birded in a game.
I don't like birding as, I know what it means, but it sounds weird as a verb.
It's kind of like someone who plays the piano being a pianist. I'm like, I know it's yeah. right, but I don't like it. Yeah. Just it's the margin. It's true, but he shouldn't say it. Yeah.
Just sounds slightly wrong enough. Something that I've been thinking about lately too, and like kind of relates to bombing and even birding, is there's a lot of like, I think, strength to including things that are just inherently creative acts in your games. Do you play Roblox?
No, but I watch all the kids at the library play it, not creepily.
There's a game in Roblox. There's like a game mode. I am completely forgetting what it's called right now. Let me do a quick search. Oh, it's called Dress to Impress. Mm. And I've watched streamers play it. I don't play Roblox. I don't really know much about Roblox. But there's a game mode called Dress to Impress. And it's basically like a competitive fashion game where you're given a theme.
Yes.
And everybody has to dress up according to that theme. And then you rate each other's themes. And then there's like a ranking board based on whoever got however many votes. And it's interesting. I've seen people who I never expected to play it really get into that game. And it seems like it's made for like, oh, you know, I don't know, girly girl demographics or whatever. Because of the themes of like fashion and like dress up. And it's very like high fashion couture modeling stuff. But it's fascinating because people who I never expect to play it are playing it. And they're having a lot of fun because they like the ability to kind of be given a tool set and like be able to experiment with it and be playful with it and like make ridiculous outfits and like have a lot of fun with that sort of setup, even though it's not necessarily their type of, I guess, game or type of theme. They're not fashion people, but they like just being given a creative palette and experimenting with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of through Bombing's design, that's kind of what I was always aiming for, is not necessarily telling you how to play the game or what to do, but just giving you a space to kind of play around with and be able to explore building and painting things how you want. And Bombing 2 is something I leaned into as well, where it's like including assets that are just interesting to paint. I don't have an idea in mind for how people are going to paint these things half the time. It's kind of on them to figure that out. But people will do interesting things if you just give them tools and people are naturally playful. So they'll just be encouraged on their own to play around with a tool set and have fun. So I think there's interesting things with creative games where they have a lot of opportunities to just get a lot of playtime out of doing stuff that is just inherently fun to do on its own with a tool set that you build for someone.
At what point does it become like just an engine and you made dreams? There's somewhere between game and tool and engine. It's a spectrum.
Yeah, honestly, exactly. Like at some point, like just building somebody a tool set, like dreams is great for that, where it's like, yeah, I don't know, we just built a bunch of junk and threw it together. You figure out what to make and people will do.
You ever wanted a visual script with a PS Move controller? No? Well, here you go.
To say nothing of the actual controls, I think that is the thing that always confused me about dreams, is like actually like figuring out all the controls for it. It's complex.
It's beautiful, but it's, I don't know. It has that other issue I have where I don't like when people make stuff on a trap platform that they're just going to delete in a couple of years.
Oh, totally.
I think all that energy should be somewhere else. But yeah, that's neither here nor there.
No, I agree totally. Like the closed ecosystem is kind of funny because, yeah, people make this amazing thing in dreams. You're like, man, if only you, I don't know, had Godot. Like,
yeah,
you could do so much.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Shout out. I wanted to ask, this kind of seems like a lame question after all this beautiful indie talk, but and I could just cut it anyway, but it was one I wrote down because I was interested in. Having worked at Ubisoft for a while and then an indie studio and then solo indie, what did you miss the most about a giant game studio, if anything? Emphasis on the if anything.
Yeah, I mean, like, it is funny. There's been a lot of reflection from me just, like, personally in my life of, like, is the games industry for me? You know, it, like, if I got back into a big game studio, would there be anything that I enjoy about it? I've kind of run a gamut. Like you said, I kind of have been in every scale studio at this point and seen a lot of the same problems throughout all of them. And, like, you know, people carry trauma or carry ideas from one studio to the next, and then those ideas are incorporated into the next studio, and then it kind of just becomes the same thing as all the other studios.
Yes.
I think the thing that I would enjoy the most about working at a big studio is just financial security. Like,
yeah.
Like, honestly, the idea that you just have a paycheck, like, you might be a cog in the machine, but at least you can put food on the table. Like,
yeah, can someone pay for my glasses, please?
Yeah.
I just really want new glasses.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, even just, you know, having that security to be able to invest in my own stuff again. Like, mm-hmm. When I was doing full-time work, a lot of the time I would just set aside some money from my paychecks every day that would go into my personal work. And it's like, okay, this can pay for, like, title art, so I can commission an artist for something. Now that
beautiful,
I'm not making any money except just through my games and not really making enough even for, you know, rent or food that much. Like, I can't afford that kind of luxury anymore. So yeah, I do miss being able to kind of repurpose a lot of the money that I'm getting and, like, be able to, you know, pay artists and stuff. Because that was also a great avenue for, I've always kind of used it as an avenue for just, like, getting people more things that they can claim as their work, right? Where it's like,
right,
hey, you made title art for this thing. You, like, if you need to put that out as a portfolio, go for it. Like, I can be a reference if you have a job interview. Like, that, it's at least something that looks better for you.
Aww.
Resume and stuff, but now I can't do that because I don't have that kind of money floating around, and it's, you know, tightening the bootstraps, no, belts, pulling, I don't know. There's a...
No, I get you. All that to say, we miss having capital.
Yes.
Capital seems to make this whole thing work easier.
But also not, I also don't. I wish I didn't have to have
capital.
To be
clear. No, hate the game, not the player, Devin. Hate the game, not the player.
No, 100%.
No, I want people to have capital who would use it to, you know, that's a whole other thing we can't get into without Steve here to check me. But... That was all I had another thought, actually. Let me close out with, you were saying earlier that it was, like, a different perspective being brought to games, and there's the two people who are the best at game design, or the like, sort of technical top 0.01% master who can look at a game and go, like, oh, is this engine, and this is probably how they did this and this and this, and they can just, like, they see the matrix code when they turn it on instantly. And that's how they assess whether it's good or not. And then there's the person who has no idea, and they're like, why don't you just do this? And you're like, that's a great idea. write that down.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of, I think those two people need to be in the same studios. And I guess that's kind of what Nintendo's doing with the people who've been making games for 40 years and all these new people who make pottery, is you have both these people next to each other. And Bill Hader has a great bit about writing scripts.
That's another thing I learned, was that when people give you notes on something, when they tell you what's wrong, they're usually right. When they tell you how to fix it, they're wrong.
They identified something and just discard, you know, what they think should happen, and it if they're not, you know, right, because you're the expert, but they are right that something's wrong there. And working with someone who has that other perspective, aside from, you know, a lot of these studios which feel like games, like, I don't know, Sid Meier is a studio now, or Firaxis, I should say, that just has 200 guys who make strategy games, and all those guys wanted to make Civ when they were going into games, and so they're making more Civ, and so Civ is getting, I want to say derivative, but it feels like every other Civ. But Nintendo games, like I said before, have that different perspective. I just rambled a bunch, Devin. I'm sorry. There was nothing to that, but I was interested in that little Bill Hader thing about identifying the problems in the games mm-hmm. and wondered if you had thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds more analogous to like playtesting to me, where like that's always the conventional wisdom with playtesting, or at least that's what I tell people when it comes to playtesting a lot of the time, is like, don't listen to the suggestions that the players have when they're playing your stuff. Listen to what they're actually saying about it. Like, if they say, this bit of the level's confusing, then and then they will probably, like, you know, everybody has opinions about stuff, and they'll probably mention, like, oh, you should do this thing. And usually they're wrong, because they don't actually know, like, the how the sausage is made behind the scenes, and usually they don't know, like, yeah, usually they don't really know the nuances there, but they might be able to identify at least the surface level issues of what's happening, and then you can kind of, you know, amalgamate that stuff with like other data to figure out what's actually going on.
Right. They don't necessarily know what's possible, but when a player is like, ah, this thing should explode when you do this, it's like, well, the player feels, I think, maybe underpowered or something here. Like, you can like suss something out of it.
People are generally good at identifying problems, but I think usually experts are the ones who are good at identifying solutions. And I think that's kind of the crux of it, is like, it's like with anything, like you and I don't know. Are you a cook? Do you cook?
I try.
Okay. Like if
pancakes.
We went to a restaurant and we ate something and we both knew that there was a problem with it, we probably couldn't necessarily tell you like how to fix it. Like, we might be able to say this meal doesn't taste good, but we might not necessarily know why it doesn't taste good. Maybe there's like acidic content, or there's not enough oil or whatever, but we know that it is a bad meal. Mm-hmm. But the chef would fix it.
An analogous experience that I really like. Thank you. So in that, we've both identified now a gaping problem in the gaping problem in the games industry in terms of cycles of violence and trauma, akin to The Last of Us 2's story, in that all of these companies are led by awful money-grubbing people who don't invest in anything interesting, and then they run people out for 3 to 6 years and spin them out into their own studios where they finally have their own power to do that, and then they do an indie studio like that for a bit, and then they grind out a bunch of people who then end up making indie games and don't make enough money and then go work somewhere else. Where are the experts? Where do we find the solutions, Devin? Do you think the games industry will unionize? We're 0-3 in Canada, like 3-6 in North America. Do you see that happening?
I hope it happens. I think it should happen. I'm going to take a moment to plug Code CWA's organizer training. You know, if you're in games want to learn a little bit about how to organize your workplace, check that out. They have free training, and it happens on a regular basis. I took it myself. It's very good. But I hope so. I mean, I think there's a lot of like misinformation, and, you know, obviously corporations are spinning unionization in a way that makes it sound scarier than it is, especially when, you know, I tried to organize my workplace, and unrelated to organizing, we all got laid off.
Wait, did you try to unionize Bean's team, Dave?
There were things we were working on. It was a little bit of an uphill battle, but I think there's a lot of misinformation. I think there's a lot of people who are very hesitant. I think there's a lot of, especially now, like, unfortunately, it seems to be taking this amount of pressure on people in studios who are like constantly worried about, you know, obviously getting laid off and losing their jobs. And I think it's unfortunate that that much pressure needs to happen in order for people to realize that like something has to kind of be done. But I think like as long as this cycle continues, it will happen, whether or not it's immediately or over time. Like, it will probably happen, because this can't keep going on like this. And now the people who have been getting laid off, or the people who have been seeking employment elsewhere, I've seen more people being vocal about unionization and organizing workplaces in the last few years than I have like ever previously in video games, because everybody has seen these cycles happening, and, you know, seen so many of their coworkers, their friends, their colleagues losing their jobs and like jumping ship and going to different industries, that I think there's people who are even like gainfully employed who are just sick of it, right? Mm.
Yeah, and if you live in Quebec, there's the Comp d'Officiel de Mouvement CSN is trying to unionize the whole Quebec games industry. They just did Bethesda, 250 Quebec devs.
Yeah.
So I should say 1-4 in Canada so far.
That's better than 0. I'll take it.
This is better than 0 for 3. Yeah, you know, uphill battle for sure, though. Anyway, we hope you, dear listener, gleaned something from this. Did you know there's a lot of game devs who listen to this, Devin?
What's that?
There's a lot of game devs who listen to this.
Good.
And I think they should unionize.
There's a lot of game devs who listen to this, you say, about
the Canadian Dave's Devs Podcast.
Well, I mean, you're hitting your target market. Well done.
Oh, man. Yeah, don't unionize with the UFCW, though. I've been told, well, they obviously messed up the first couple, but you should go with Unifor, apparently. I've been talking to a lot of labor historians at different universities because no one in the press is going to write about the Joy Drop story, and I don't want to get sued on Canadian Game Devs. So we're trying to get it like in a journal somewhere, and so I talked to some labor historians, and that might be the best way to get done. But every single one of them was like, oh, you went with UFCW? And like, don't do that. And like, where were you guys when I needed you? Anyway, probably have to cut all that. Damn, so I can cut. I can stop recording. I just want to ask about stuff, but I don't know if you can. But okay, wait. We should sign off. Devin, we're obviously going to put your curator page, Twitter, top of the show notes, but where would you like people to find you elsewhere on the internet?
Sure.
Besides those two places.
I'm on Blue Sky at Devin_Wiersma. I am on Tumblr at Devs Games.
Hell yeah, a Tumblr plug in 2024, yes. Folks.
Hey, I'm a big fan of the indie game dev scene on Tumblr because it's a lot of just like younger people just figuring out how game dev tools work and doing weird stuff. So if you're interested in like weird experimental things, I actually would recommend Tumblr, surprisingly.
We'll plug Devin's Tumblr, tap the show.
Yeah, and then I'm also on YouTube, where you can see my video essays at SlaughterNeko, N-E-K-O. And I'm on Twitch, where I stream licensed games one day a week on Monday mornings. I'll play licensed games and usually have a really weird time with it. It's great.
Man, all right, I'm going to watch that video you posted, and I'm going to tune in to the next stream, because this is some good shit, Devin.
Hell yeah.
And Devin is also one of our patrons at SlaughterNeko. Thank you, Devin, for your support.
Oh, yes, of course.
All these years. We deeply appreciate both financial and just coming on and talking to us about this goddamn industry, because I'm so sick of it.
Me too. Don't worry. You're
I'm so sick of it.
Hey, you're not the only one.
They say I'm a dreamer,
but I'm not the only one.
I kind of bumbled the start of this, Devin. I'm going to edit all this to sound a little better. Don't worry.
Perfect.
The power of editing.